Tonight we've got Bill Martin.
Thank you very much, Brian. Thank you everyone for coming along. This is an unusual experience for me because I can't make any contact with anyone I'm speaking to. But it does mean that means I can concentrate entirely on my notes. So, Brian's introduction, I think I should start with a note on language, which is I am a horrific monoglot. There will occasionally be Spanish, Italian, and French words cropping up that I will horribly mangle. But my apologies there. And I do wonder what the actual correct pronunciation of pasadas is, because I've only ever seen it written down. So if I'm saying it entirely wrong, and if there's any Spanish speakers out there or any Argentinians, all I can do is apologize and say I'm just sounding out words as best I can. So the topic of this talk is J Posadas, and the J apparently does not mean anything. It is just an initial that was used for a collective name for the leadership of a Latin American Trotskyist group. And it's the claim to fame of J Posadas is he's a bit of a laugh among train spotters, chiefly known for believing in nuclear war and aliens. And this got to the point where it was a feature article in the Fortean Times. I think I first came across him, I don't know, I think some sort of connection via the Ken MacLeod mentioned him in one of his books or somewhere on Twitter or something like that. But generally, it's this obscure topic. And he kind of got a resurgence in the last few years because he became an internet meme and associated with the phrase luxury gay space communism. Or variants, that sort of thing. And of course, the idea being because of his outlandish views on aliens and therefore on the hopefulness. Fortunate for once, this is something we probably should have done years ago, in being able to tie up an article in the Socialist Standard with a talk. And I think that's more by luck than by planning in this instance. I kind of expected book review to come into next month's Standard. I sent in two articles at once and they both got used in the same month, which means I have to do even more work. But briefly, I don't want to therefore regurgitate everything that's in the article. I want to concentrate on other parts of the story, and particularly the significance of J. Posadas, other than talking about his biography as such, although I will expand on various details that I left out of what was essentially a quick book review. But if you want more details, I highly recommend to read the article and read the book it's based on, which is I Want to Believe, Posadas, UFOs and Apocalypse Communism by A.M. Gitlitz. I'm going to do is I'm going to give a very brief potted history of J. Posadas, or Homero Cristalli, which is his real name. And then I'm going to talk about him being an effective leader in terms of left-wing politics and Trotskyism. And then I'm going to look at him as, in fact, an exemplar as an orthodox Trotskyist, and how that you seeing him that way enables us to read into his life story and his work. And to draw out the significance, because it basically is the significance of theory and practice of Trotskyism as seen in Central and Latin America. And then I'm going to look at his route to as a so-called weirdo or strange cult-like leader is actually not that unusual within the Trotskyist milieu, as some people would put it. Also to look at how has elements of his story have traces in the micro sects and cults, and to think about what sort of steps are needed in these sort of tiny committed organizations to prevent someone of his type coming forward, and how individuals like him do seem to come forward and breed in the kind of highly organized and committed sorts of organizations that you find with revolutionary groups. Pardon me a second. The biography was born in 1912, and he was a child of Italian immigrants. There was lots of Italian immigration to Argentina around this time. His parents were active in the Italian Socialist Party and trade unionists, and they were his father was a shoemaker. So he was born into a household that had radical roots. He himself managed to shoe working in the shoemaking industry. And formed a part of a group of kids who went around singing in bars, and making up poems and generally performing. And later, as part of his claim to fame and notoriety, he was a professional footballer. He played a very minor role. I think some people dispute whether or not he actually made professional appearances for his team, but it does seem he's probably a substitute or a minor player. And of course, we're talking about a time when recording of such details won't have been tremendous. Came to the notice of the nascent Trotskyist groups in Latin America, in Argentina, because he sent a poem calling for unity over the Civil War to a radical newspaper, part of the Socialist Party in Argentina. And so they invited him, they took a shine to him, invited him in to start their groups, and indoctrinated him into Trotskyism. At the time, there was only a handful of intellectuals, so they were distant from any sort of formal workers' movement. And as the book notes, they were referred to, I don't think by Trotsky, but by someone else, I think. Probably even the author of a thesis as coffee bar wankers, but I can't exclude the possibility that Trotsky called them something similar in Russian or Spanish, but I don't think likely. He was highly committed. Know this. He got into his autobiography. Instead of giving his beloved, when he proposed marriage to her, a wedding ring, he gave her a copy of Trotsky's Transitional Program, which is very sweet in its own way, but also a sign of his commitment and obviously of her commitment as well. Was and became a professional revolutionary. To the extent that he, when there was splits and threats to the organizational existence of the Latin American Bureau of the Fourth International, he was threatened with very actual penury. And this marks out a feature of his life that he depended all entirely for his life upon the income from the international, then from the Latin American organizations he was associated with and set up. And in fact, he's a good example. Someone pointed to Mr. Mandel's book on bureaucracy of the typical bureaucrat, and Mandel, a Trotskyist himself, equivocates. He goes, yes, bureaucrats are bad, but we do need them. And they're fairly conservative because they're looking for their own self-interest to maintain their organization and their own income, first and foremost. That's where he comes in, and you can read a lot of his life in those terms. And he was very loyal to a character called Pablo initially. Pablo was the leading secretary of the Fourth International, and basically Posadas, or sorry, Cristalli, backed him up in various faction fights. Particularly after the death of Trotsky, as the Fourth International and its various factions and international parties vied for control, and also of the various individuals who sought to be the new grand old man of the international organization. And of course, that meant that his section got funding, and it continued to exist largely through the money that came in from the International Bureau and or the Secretariat or whatever of the Fourth International. So this so far, and this so far so typical, what an unusual person and deserving of a decent footnote in history. Was effective leader. In 1937, he was tasked by his nascent Trotskyist organisation to go and build a strike in Cordoba. She successfully did, and he built up the union. He tramped around, did decorating jobs, and then stood around outside the shoe factory gates, agitating and building up a union and for a successful strike. That was also where he met his wife, so that was fairly useful for him. In 1938, he stood for election on behalf of the workers, the Revolutionary Workers' Party, and they got a vote. They got a substantial vote, but not a huge one. He wasn't elected. Of course, that means that his name became known in Buenos Aires. He was not a hidden individual. I think this is the other thing that comes forward, is that he's someone who's built a reputation, not just wasn't just a background bureaucrat, and I'll come to background bureaucrats in Trotskyist organisations later in the talk. His reputation was further built as he became the de facto leader. So at first he was just a part of a collective leadership who all signed themselves J. Posadas. But he became eventually the maximum leader, partly because other people dropped away as they disagreed with the various relations of the Fourth International. And he was the one who was loyal to Pablo. He was able to stay in charge. And various permutations on the Revolutionary Workers Party, brackets Trotskyist, spread through Latin America. And I think it's significant they held on to, they were a bracket party, a Trotskyist, much like you get Communist Party, Marxist-Leninist, and Communist Party, Marxist, or Communist Party, Leninist in various parts of the world. They publicly were known as Trotskyists, and they held the torch for Trotskyism in Latin America. In 1952, the Revolutionary Nationalist Movement had an armed revolution in Bolivia, and the Partido Obrero Revolucionario was a small wheel in a party of no more than 1,000 members. Obviously, this enabled them to claim a very great deal that they were responsible for or heavily involved in this revolution in Bolivia. In 1958, the Peronist movement, and I think Peronism will return later in this talk, was and in Argentina, and the Revolutionary Workers' Party, they had to drop the revolutionary. They just became the workers, the Workers' Party Trotskyist. Sorry, missed one. They again stood in elections, and they didn't get a huge vote, but they getting votes of something like 15,000 votes compared to the Communist Party's 69,000. So they weren't unheard of. They were putting forward the idea of Trotskyism, and he was at the centre of this spread of radicalism in Latin America. And various sections under his leadership spread throughout the world. So they tried to build Spanish section under the Francoist regime. So that's a fairly serious undertaking. He sent his son to Syria to build a section against the Baathist regime. And considering other Trotskyists, particularly the Workers' Revolutionary Party, very careful with this leftist alphabet spaghetti in Britain, oriented itself very heavily towards taking Baathist money not long after that. And this is the one I'm kind of building up to for a slightly longer quote. They built up a section in Greece under the Greek colonels. And this is what was written in their paper, Communist Struggle, which announced their formation as a direct result of Basadas' brilliance. Most lively and most eloquent expressions of the role of the individual in history. And this expresses the needs which are not individual but collective and historical, when an individual armed with theoretical and political assurance based on scientific Marxist concept is capable of concentrating and centralizing all the force, all the potency of the international, capable of concentrating in a conscious and scientific way the objective, empirical, and unconscious necessities of history. The goal of Comrade J. Posadas in the constitution of our Greek sex is not the force of an individual, but all the power and all the historic assurance of the Fourth International. This work is concentrating its preoccupation, its activities, among the conscious centres, which in united front with the revolutionary tendencies of the masses, decide the future course of history in Europe and the world, the sections of the international. Well, that if you can. Obviously, second, this is an exemplar of the heavily stream of consciousness and jargon heavy sorts of texts that were produced by the Posadists. It's a good example of how it was a kind of a cult of personality around him. This was backed up by the fact that sometime in the 1940s, someone gave him access to a tape recorder, which meant that he wasn't himself a natural writer. Having a tape recorder meant that he could just speak out his stream of consciousness documents, and we'll come to a very good example of that in a short time, then get a secretary to write them up. And then this built up his reputation as a guru within Trotskyism. He really, the thinking is, really, he's not an intellectual of that sort. He was uneducated. He kind of absorbed his Trotskyism, then learned how to use it to maintain his position in a wider organization and to make the sort of noises that people want to hear. And we've had that experience ourselves when we've tried to set up international sections. People learn fairly quickly, thinking of the Ukrainian scandal, who just regurgitate back to us what we expected to hear. And I think this is a very good case that this is what he was doing here. So it was not insignificant, and his interventions were certainly also brave and committed. So he did help build up not just revolutionary organizations in Latin America, but also the world. But eventually, he led a split against Pablo, who had just been arrested for helping to send arms to the Algerian National Liberation Forces. And he took that opportunity to say that the leadership of the Fourth International should move to Latin America and to him to take over. And he ended up expelling European sections, which is why he had to start setting up. And in fact, he even had a Revolutionary Workers' Party Trotskyist or group in Britain. He took a dislike to the fact that they were all vegetarians. He considered that eating meat is a good and manly thing to do. So what we have is a picture of someone who is committed, who genuinely was part of a culture of radical dissent, and who found a place for himself, just as a guru, but also bureaucrat and leader, and who was prominent and well known in that capacity. In many ways, he was, although he's known for his slightly weird views, an orthodox Trotskyist. Famously, in the transitional program for the Fourth International, the opening line is that the crisis of the proletariat is a crisis of leadership. There was entirely focus on leadership and changing the leaders. So it's no wonder that this one man, this idea that the maximum leader is the force and the leader, lever that moves the whole revolution, would begin to promote himself in that role. It's not just the leadership issue. It is a certain element that, you know, you hear from various people. People like Christopher Hitchens would go, oh, what a genius Trotsky was, and you could read his writings. They're quite remarkable with their sophistication. I read Trotsky, and I was so fundamentally underwhelmed, because it all could be summed up. I mean, again, as I say in the review in the Standard, go back to your constituencies and prepare for civil war. Its entire theory is that the revolution and war is the civil war is the same thing, and that the way to successfully promote the revolution is to win the civil war, to basically repeat experience of Russia, and therefore to form the nucleus of a command control organization or a new Red Army. But this is coupled with the theory of democratic centralism, or Trotsky just refers to it as centralism, which animates the idea that there's a central group, and of course within that central group it's the leadership of one man, and that one man originally was Trotsky, and with his death that role became vacant. This means that Crystalli's an attachment to nuclear war is in fact entirely consistent with Trotskyism at the time. Trotsky had staked the farm on World War II. So he said, well, this are in charge, World War II will come along, and this will sweep away the Nazis, this will sweep away everything, and the World Revolution will begin. So World War I started everything, World War II will sort things out for us. And that didn't happen. Stalin held fast, he stayed in charge. Worldwide Trotskyism stood by the unconditional defence of the Soviet Union, also therefore for fighting on the sides in the war. They did stand for arming the working class and this sort of thing, but chiefly the idea that the Soviet Union had the economic form of socialism, but that Mr. Stalin was the political deformation, and that with political revolution, the revolution could be put back on its way. And in fact, realistically, you can see Trotskyism as a kind of loyal opposition or even an alibi. You want to support the Russian Revolution but want to denounce anything that you see wrong with it. You say, well, I'm with Trotsky, and then anything that's wrong with the revolution is the fault of Mr. Stalin. And Trotsky, the great man, put it right, it's very much a great man theory of history. Not bad Mr. Stalin made it go wrong, but Mr. Trotsky would make it go right. At the time of the Cuban crisis, the idea that nuclear war, the way forward, wasn't just Crystalli's. Famously, Castro and Guevara were urging Khrushchev to break the US blockade and start the nuclear war. And the idea being twofold. One, the imperialist powers who now have nukes, will not just give up position in the world. So that means that nuclear war is inevitable, because inevitably there will be revolt against the imperialist powers, and that means that they will unleash their nukes, and therefore the workers' states need to have nukes to fire back. But also there was a secondary concern, which would be that there are more people in the communist world than in the capitalist, and therefore the idea is, once almost everything has been wiped out, that which remains will be communist, and that will take over the world and produce communism. So, the price is worth paying for infinite future generations versus finite numbers now. It's a horrific scenario, one that a great many of the left, certainly in Europe, shied away from. And of course, we can see that possibly one part of this story is people who lived under the shadow of the bomb, who were likely to be hit by it, didn't want the nuclear war, whereas people in Latin America were probably more likely to say, well, we're not going to get nuked. The theory of the nuclear winter wasn't as expounded at the time. Therefore, will sweep away the thing that's holding us back and get us there. So the idea that he's a bit of a weirdo because his group supported the workers' bomb. It's just that they continued to do so openly and proudly after everyone else backed away because Cubans had to accommodate to Khrushchev and towards easing Moscow because they became a satellite of Russia. And European groups famously supported banning the bomb, unilateral disarmament in the UK and the West. Unilateral disarmament objectively meant letting the Russians keep hold of their bombs, both the CIA and a lot of the right saw that sort of position. Well, on to the most famous thing for which Posadas, and that is for writing an article about aliens. And in fact, so the entire title is Flying Saucers, the Process of Matter and Energy, Science, the Revolutionary and Working Class Struggle, and the Socialist Future of Mankind. It is available online. There's a link in the article in the Standard, but you can find it on the Marxist Internet Archive. And I will just make a note on language here. So that it was translated presumably from the Italian or the Spanish into French. That's what it was published in. And the version they've got up there is further translated into English. So it's hard to know how much of the interesting stylistics is in fact multiple errors carried on through mistranslation and how much of it is a capture of the reality of what was said. But in many ways, large chunks of it are quite hard to read. And, you know, when he says something along the lines of in the Soviet Union, they have discovered a ray infinitely faster than light, which is something totally new. I mean, it almost sounds like something Donald Trump would say, doesn't it? And there's another element that maybe he was speaking extempore and someone translated. I mean, imagine taking down this talk word for word and trying to make it into flowing prose. It would look very strange. So this, you have to bear that in mind when reading it. And some of it isn't entirely nonsense. You're pointing out that scientists are aid who funds them for their science is an interesting and useful point. But the point about what he says in this article, according to Gitlitz, is that he's wanting to stymie discussions that are going on within his group as people are discovering extraterrestrials and aliens, and he's wanting to put a kibosh on this internal discussion. So he's trying to have the final word on aliens among a group of people who are professional revolutionaries who travel in the world and who are just generally absorbing the wonderful ideas. And of course, the idea of UFOs and extraterrestrials was out there in the time. And in many ways, as Gitlitz points out, this was just a stick with which other Trotskyist sects could turn around and beat Cristalli's outfit. It's you know, a la carte Trotskyism. Whatever one policy you can use to differentiate yourselves from your neighbours, you use to the fullest extent to point out that we're the sane ones. They're a bunch of nutters who believe in nuclear bombs and aliens. Don't go to them. Come to us and we'll explain to you all about why Trotsky was right to shoot them down like partridges in Kronstadt. So, if you'll forgive me a second, I'll just get up some quotes. He says in that article, it's consistent with kind of Trotskyism that he developed under. And this is kind of a standard one for the sort of stagist Marxists. The most immediate consequence we can draw is that if these beings do exist, they must have a societal organization superior to our own. Their appearances are not the effect of bellicose or aggressive sentiments. If aliens exist, must be communists, or a stage beyond communism, more than communism. they exist, as we must call on them to intervene, to help us resolve the problems we have on Earth. The essential task is to suppress poverty, hunger, unemployment and war, to give everyone the means to live in dignity and to lay the basis for human fraternity. To this end, we must suppress the capitalist system as well as the bureaucracy of the workers' states, communist parties who do not want to seize power. I mean, why not? I mean, yeah, if the aliens do come along, please save us from ourselves. This is very much of a piece with the kind of politics that he was developing. We must appeal to the beings of other planets when they come here to intervene, collaborate with Earth's inhabitants in suppressing poverty. We must make this call to them. It is impossible. It is possible to make ourselves understood to them. Now, this might seem relatively strange. However, it must be borne in mind that the Cristalli came to political maturity under the period of Peronism in Argentina. Peron orientated himself as a populist and managed to convince large sections of the workers' movement to support him. In his first term in office. In his second term, he turned around and turned on the workers, but they were the ones who had agitated him for him to return, very much used in the classical strongman sort of way. So the organization of Trotskyism in Argentina was very much orientating itself towards the Perón movement, towards the workers that supported him, and saying, well, okay, we will infiltrate and engage in entryism among Peronism, and orientate towards a strong individual who will bring about the revolution. And of course, if you have a theory of revolution as coming about as a form of political revolution after a seizure of power, normally through civil war, but if you can do it through an organization coming to power and using political authority to create socialism, then of course this kind of makes sense as a step, next step for a Trotskyist organization. And in fact, one of the rows in the Fourth International that Posadas himself involved in was very much about should they start orientating themselves towards official communist parties. Whether I'm going on for a little bit longer than I expected to, but I'm coming into the final straits. Sorry, missed that one. He did come up with an original position of his own, which is he started to talk about monolithism rather than democratic centralism, which in practice meant that he had an absolute and total control of the whole organization. Now, this total and absolute control meant down to controlling the lives of their members. He would forbid members to marry. He would move married members away from each other so that they couldn't be together where they were working. It meant totally taking control of their lives and making himself the one supreme of the entire organization, no matter where it was in the world. So that's why Posadas is interesting as Trotskyist, as an example of Trotskyism, and in fact that this was a well-beaten path within the Trotskyist movement. In this country, Jerry Healey from the Workers' Revolutionary Party. Again, a fairly similar character in as much as a lot of the intellectuals and the so-called middle-class elements within the party saw him as something authentic. He was an authentic worker in amongst all of themselves. And they were shut off from the working class but wanting to somehow orientate and relate to it. That degenerated to his complete control of the organization and the sexual exploitation of female members and his control and the total loyalty of those around him to the point that when this was exposed, it was seen as some sort of right-wing deviationist plot rather than the exposure of someone in a position of authority abusing their power. Quite in the same world, but in France, the Union Communiste Internationale, publishers of Lutouvrier, a leader, Hardy, Robert Barcia, said of his members they were supposed to be soldier monks, not petty bourgeois playing at politics. And he said to them, well, you can't marry. If you're married, you must have no children. And this is an organization that's still extant, as is Starley's organization, the Workers' Revolutionary Workers' Party. Get that the right way around. And these habits of clandestine organization, of being a very small, very committed group surrounding a leader who has complete authority, is replete. But one of the other things that I found interesting just reading about his life was towards the end, when he was caught having an affair with a much younger, he was in his 50s, she was in her 20s, member of the organization. He accused all, Cristalli accused all of the other leading members of being promiscuous, and said that they were all as much to blame as him. And he expelled them all, and then married the girl he was having an affair with, had a child with her, and then started having these fantasies that his child was going to be some sort of messiah. He completely gone off the rails by this time. But it reminded me very much. I've just been listening not long ago to a series of podcasts on Radio 5 called End of Days, which are still available online, about David Koresh, Waco and the Branch Davidian. And some elements of this story struck me as similar in as much as Koresh started taking claims to sexual control over the females within that cult. And also the story of the 30 Britons who went over there with him, because these people committed themselves. That was kind of the thing that came across, was he decided to go over to America and join this Adventist splinter group and live under the tutelage of Koresh. And very much part of what kept them there and what kept him in control was the feeling that they had committed themselves. It seems to be there's this repeating process within, slightly cut off from the rest of the world, self-defining groups with an authoritarian leader figure that eventually leads to sort of controlling and then sexually abusive behavior and among other things. It's not just a problem of Trotskyism. It is a problem of committed groups that divorce themselves, often see themselves in relation to society, and possibly who have some sort of millenarian view on the rest of the world. Hopefully, having gone on slightly too long, I think I thought I only had four substantive points to make, but I seem to have made a lot more. What I've covered is a potted biography of Jaimero Cristalli, his role as an effective leader in terms of Trotskyism and left-wing politics, and a notable one at that, how he relates to Orthodox Trotskyism and the problems that arise from that ideology and theory of political action, how that relates to a further problem of the revolutionary minority and committed people in a tightly knit organization, and one that I think we can draw a conclusion from that need to take active steps to avoid that sort of level of personal control and living apart from society. Any sort of revolutionary group needs to be based in and through normal life, as it were, rather than shutting themselves away and having someone impose complete personal control. Thank you very much for listening. And I think it's discussion and comment struck questions time now. So I'll hand you back to the comrade chair.